Welcome to the Debate at GI8 podcast series. Today we'll be talking to national security expert, ANU Professor Rory Medcalf, about security concerns with a focus on our own backyard, the Indo-Pacific. Professor Medcalf has 3 decades of experience as a diplomat, intelligence analyst, academic, and contributor to various think tanks. He's considered a world leader when it comes to our region. My name's Ron Cantlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. In the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, who, like me, is keen to find out where Australia sits in a complex and changing geopolitical environment. Professor Rory Medcalf, thank you very much for joining our podcast. First, let's get a handle on your career and the work you've done over the past 30 years or more. Take us back to the beginning, because you have this particular interest in the Indo-Pacific. How did that develop over time?
So I guess my career has come to the Indo-Pacific and strategic issues and Australia's national interests by something of a zigzag route. In fact, my first professional experience was in journalism quite a long time ago, late 1980s, early 1990s. And in fact, having then, as a journalist, done some reporting on security issues, particularly on the Northern Ireland peace process in the early 90s, I got really interested in international security and diplomacy. And that ultimately led me to joining the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade as a graduate recruit. And really, professionally, my interest in Asia and the Indo-Pacific began through my time in foreign affairs in the 1990s. I was posted to India in 2000, so 3 years from 2000 to 2003. I was in a key role at the Australian High Commission in New Delhi in what I think was a pivotal time in India's emergence as a world power, as an international power. I also worked shortly after that in the Australian Intelligence Community, the Office of National Assessments, now the Office of National Intelligence. And the opportunity to thread all of those elements together was to look at power relations among countries in Australia's region, how this was all changing, what was certainly the impact of the rise of China on all of that, and to begin to identify some patterns of meaning to inform Australian policymakers. And so the idea of the Indo-Pacific, which many voices have influenced over the past 20 years, but the idea of the Indo-Pacific as one connected strategic system around Australia, the Indian and Pacific Oceans as one system, if you like, rather than two, is something that all of that work, particularly my work in foreign affairs, in India, in Office of National Assessments, and subsequently leaving government at the Lowy Institute, it all began to make sense to me probably around 15 years ago.
And much of this is condensed in the book Contest for the Indo-Pacific, which came out in 2020.
Yeah, so my book on the Indo-Pacific, and there's a more recent edition which tries to bring the story up to speed with events like AUKUS and the Quad and COVID and so forth. That book is an attempt to tell the long story, or condense the long story, of how our region, Australia's region, has become a more integrated system strategically, economically, diplomatically, and how, in fact, if you look at the deep history of the region, there are resonances of that. There are almost anticipations of that in pre-modern times, in the way that civilizations in our region engage with one another. And so the book is my attempt to try and pull those threads together from an Australian perspective, an Australian national interest perspective, and help inform the way governments and policymakers in this country think about how to advance Australia's interests in the world. And I think, you know, a key message there is the reminder that it's a multipolar region. It's always been a multipolar region. Sure, the rise of China is important and consequential, and sure, the United States is and remains, an extremely powerful and important actor. But there are all these other players too: India, Indonesia, Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, indeed Europe's role in the region, And we underestimate Australia's agency if we don't look at those partners.
So, first of all, it's great that you're a former journo. Three journos in the room, what can go wrong?
Yeah.
And there's hope for us yet, Ron. Yes. We've got a stellar career still ahead of us, no doubt.
I've wasted my career.
But I'm just interested in that comment you made about also the, you know, us in the region, it is multipolar, but also the role of Europe. So as you know, I'm heading off to Europe very soon and with the European Australian Business Council. And there seems to be a lot more focus, particularly from our counterparts in Brussels and in France, to the region. So do you think that it's, and our agency and how we play into that, I guess, is it that they just haven't considered the region in the same way that we have, or is it just because of shifting sort of geopolitical plates that suddenly they're interested in it and they're still seeing it as the two superpowers, if you like, of China and the US and, oh, there's this region and that's our role to play? I'm just interested in that Europe connection.
Look, I think the Europe connection in the Indo-Pacific is important, and in a way I've been on a bit of a journey on this one, because in my early time in DFAT, I was probably socialised into the view that I think was quite prevalent in Australian foreign policy thinking, that Europe doesn't matter so much anymore, and that we need to look so primarily at geography that we need to focus on countries that are quite close to us geographically. Whereas in fact, in a world that even now is effectively globalised and deeply interconnected, even if there are some elements of deglobalisation going on, not only is Europe important, but in many ways, Europe's becoming more consequential to the Indo-Pacific and vice versa. Because if you take the view that I think is quite firmly held in China, in the Chinese strategic community, if you start looking at the poles of power and influence in the world, sure, the United States and China are the big two, but Europe's really number three ahead of Russia, Japan, India. Because it's not only about military power, it is about economic power, it's about normative and moral power, it's about technology standards. And by every metric, as Europe, I think, becomes more mobilised as a response of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as players in Europe begin to recognise that not only can they be a kind of third way that's not the US or China, but also that they have an enormous amount to offer this region in terms of development partnership, education partnership, technology, and some pretty hard security equities as well. I think we're going to see more and more Europe being part of this regional conversation. And I think over time, the Australian policy elite will begin to recognise that and in fact be looking for ways for Australian and European partners to cross-pollinate with ideas and collaboration. Look, I think just to end that point, if you're looking at the downside of the Europe-Indo-Pacific connection, you can argue, well, of course, Europe's been here before in a colonial, imperial sense going back hundreds of years. In fact, a lot of the modern ideas of the Indo-Pacific partly relate to the fact that the region was sort of broken down and then knitted together by the economic and trade ties of the European empires. But the Europe that's engaging with the Indo-Pacific now is not the Europe of pre-1945 or of the 19th century. And in fact, a lot of the useful consequential powers from Europe in the Indo-Pacific, the EU players, are not necessarily the former colonial powers. I mean, France may be an exception there. But also, for example, Germany, the Nordics, there's a whole lot for us to explore there, and we'd be very foolish if we didn't make the most of learning from their resilience and helping add Europe to that that web of partnership that Australia needs as a middle power.
So our trade minister right now is in Brussels trying to finalise a free trade agreement with the EU, putting aside, you know, what we hear about in terms of geographical indicators and all of those sorts of things. Does it make the agreement even more important at a strategic level? So take away the transactional nature of it being a service agreement. It strikes me from your commentary that, in fact, it's far more deeper than that.
Well, Europe is a key part of the diversification agenda. So if you look at the Australian response, not only to the difficulties, the economic coercion and the tensions with China over the years, but also the Australian response to the impact of the pandemic and the recognition that in any, and I mean the impact of the pandemic on our economy and on supply chains and so forth, that it's completely unwise for Australia to assume that we can always rely on one partner for anything. There's health and survival in diversification. And so the Europeans are looking precisely at us with the same lens, by the way. If you talk to Germans, for example, about, in many cases, their newfound interest in Australia as a provider of minerals and resources, it makes good sense. And so I think that over time you will see, it's not going to be a miracle cure or a silver bullet, but you will see Australia and Europe become pillars of stability for one another, despite the distance, and in some ways even because of it.
Rory, one question I want to ask, you mentioned before you described Australia as a middle power. Do you think that's an apt description? And how are we seen in the Indo-Pacific more generally? Are we seen as a middle power? Are we seen as an emerging, you know, player in this area?
We have to find labels, right? And the labels are never perfect. They're always a bit arbitrary. So middle power is in itself a pretty problematic label. And there are plenty of academic colleagues who will, you know, very thoughtfully unpack the limitations of that. But we have to start somewhere. And Australia clearly isn't a great power in the sense that it's a country that can exert its will in the world purely through force and strategic weight, nor are we a small inconsequential country. I think the chancellor of this university, Julie Bishop, when she was foreign minister, liked to say we were a top 20 country. And in fact, by any metric, Australia is well and truly in the top 20, in some ways in the top 10 or 12 countries in the world. So Australia matters, but Australia can only achieve its objectives in partnerships. We have to have a premium on partnerships because our national interests are much larger, much greater than our capabilities to fulfil those interests. Look at our geography, look at the scale of our region, and look at the challenges in our region. That then goes to your question about how are we perceived. I'm always a little bit wary of generalisations here. I don't think that the region thinks X or the region thinks Y. The region, and the Indo-Pacific is a great descriptor of that, because it's a big, diverse region. Many countries and also many non-state actors, all with their own interests and perception. And so they all actually see Australia in somewhat different ways. And it's to our advantage to actually play to that diversity of views. So, of course, there is one perception held at different levels in parts of the region that Australia, as an ally of the United States, is always going to be a country that's aligned one way on the big international strategic issues. There's also going to be a perception that Australia is a country with a very strong trade and in some other areas, economic relationship with China, is a country that is going to have its freedom of manoeuvre constrained by that reality. But there's another perception, which I think this government is playing to pretty effectively at the moment, and that is that even within those pillars and constraints that I've mentioned, Australia has a lot of independent agency, a lot of freedom of manoeuvre as a power that itself is not intimidating, but it has capabilities it can bring to the table as a development assistance partner, as a partner in security and capacity building, and certainly, and I'm sure we'll come to this, as an education superpower, because that is one area where Australia does have outsized weight. I think there is still a lot of scope for Australia to play as a middle power in the Indo-Pacific, to demonstrate to partners elsewhere in the world, including in Europe, as we've mentioned, what we can do with that agency, and to build creative coalitions and partnerships using that agency. And some of those coalitions will include the United States, for example, the Quad dialogue, but others don't necessarily include the United States. Now, there's more we can do with Indonesia. There's more we can do with a country like France or with a country like South Korea, countries that themselves identify as being somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, although I'm sure I have some French friends who would call France a great power still. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the exciting place that our diplomacy is in. There are debates as to whether that has waxed and waned over the years. I'm a little bit more, I guess, understanding of the way in which probably the previous coalition governments approached this with their focus on the Quad and their focus on AUKUS, for example. But the government we have now, the Labor government, is doing a very effective job of picking the best of what previous governments have done and then, if you like, revitalising the missing middle, the relations with ASEAN and Southeast Asia. So to really cut a long answer short, I think that it's really up to us as a nation to shape how we're perceived and never be captive to the idea that there is one regional view that we need to be defensive about.
So this seems to be a moment in time in many ways. We've sort of zigzagged our way there, as you have with your career in many ways. I like your description of the potential of being an education superpower, and of course that's germane to what the Group of Eight and universities more broadly in Australia are about. And I think that is an area where we are particularly different than our US counterparts or even our European and UK counterparts and Canadian counterparts indeed. Obviously, because I'm from the Group of Eight, I'm also interested in the research side of that equation. Do you think that what I'm taking from you is that this government perhaps recognises the power of soft diplomacy, and that usually is in the sort of mobility of people and students. What about the research side, building capability and capacity both ways? Because there's often a discussion about what we can do for you, but I'm interested in your view around whether we are underutilising that, and if not, or if we are, how do we actually capitalise on that?
Lots of questions there, and I think that opens a really fruitful conversation, Vicky. I think that firstly, we have to start with the recognition, the respect, and frankly, the celebration of the fact that the academic sector in Australia is independent. The academic sector does have academic independence, and that's one of the great qualities of democracy, of liberal democracy, that's evolved over hundreds of years. So that character, it's not just a character, that nature isn't going to change and shouldn't change. Having said that, I think there is more that can be done in partnership to harness the breadth and the depth of expertise within the universities and the needs of government, the needs of the policy community, because this is a time where Australia cannot afford to be less than the sum of its parts. You know, we are in a competitive international environment. No matter how one reads the risks and the threats, there are plenty of risks and threats out there, and no one is going to do Australia any favours in that regard. We're going to have to demonstrate that we know what our weight is and we know how to use it, and do that as a democracy. But nonetheless, government needs to be, in my view, more open to finding creative ways to leverage the expertise in universities. And I don't just mean in sciences and in technology, but of course, for example, with the AUKUS ambition coming down the pipeline now, of course, the expertise in Australian universities does need to be engaged, but also in the social sciences and the humanities, you know, understanding the region, understanding the Indo-Pacific, understanding Asia, understanding diplomacy, understanding regional security, all of these areas that we've touched on in this conversation, the academic and research sectors more broadly are a national force multiplier. Incentives need to be created and channels of communication need to be fostered, because there are very different cultures between, as I know full well from the job I do at the National Security College, there are very different cultures in the security community, in the public service on the one hand, and the academic community on the other. And in fact, beyond that, the media, the think tank community, there's, you know, there are plenty of other providers and developers and curators of knowledge out there, even if they don't do it with the same depth that we do in the academic space. I'm still a believer that there are ways that can not necessarily reconcile, but combine many of those areas of insight and wisdom and knowledge for the national interest broadly defined. We don't need to agree on everything. We shouldn't agree on everything. There needs to be respectful engagement. But I do think at the moment that the governmental systems of harnessing that are still quite immature. And I also, maybe controversially, would say within academic culture, there is scope for some adjustment to recognise that not everything government needs or wants us to do is necessarily bad for academic independence. In many ways, universities contributing to a policy debate that actually protects democratic resilience, protects liberal democratic values, makes Australia stronger and more respected in the region, it's going to be good for university culture in the long run as well.
You mentioned, Professor Medcup, before the threats that Australia faces in this changing geopolitical world in the Indo-Pacific. Brings us to AUKUS and the decision to invest in nuclear-powered subs. How does that change the perception of Australia in the Indo-Pacific?
So AUKUS obviously is consequential in many ways. It is something of a game changer. And I think to the credit of our diplomats and actually our foreign minister in particular, in recent months, there's been a very sober, active, consistent campaign to put AUKUS in context, to put it in its place and explain that, sure, it's a game changer in the sense that it will deliver Australia very substantial military weight, but it doesn't change the nature of Australia as a partner in the region. It's not Australia wholeheartedly becoming a kind of flag bearer for Anglosphere partners at the expense of regional engagement. We can be a close and trusted security partner of the US and Britain on the one hand, and a serious partner and actor in Asia and the Indo-Pacific on the other. And I think that message is now beginning to sink in. The fact that, you know, these days, even the president of Indonesia will say quite openly, look, AUKUS will be fine as long as it's about partnership. And so the obligation is now on the Australian government to keep proving and affirming that point. But it is going to be constantly challenging work because there is an active campaign, understandably, by the Chinese government, by the Russian government as well, to run a counter-narrative or, as some observers would say, really a disinformation narrative to say that AUKUS is going to make Australia this bastion of containment. I think one of the most useful ways of describing it, which I actually heard a senior Australian official use recently, it was in a closed door setting, but I think I can repeat it, to actually a number of regional voices who were asking questions about AUKUS, and to a Chinese official who was asking questions about AUKUS, the message was, look, let's just look at the capability this will deliver. In time, it means that Australia will have a number of nuclear-powered but conventionally armed submarines operating effectively in a region where there are already a growing number of nuclear-powered and, in some cases, nuclear-armed submarines under a Chinese flag. So in that sense, that was kind of a bracing jolt to a few in the region who were buying some of the misinformation. The more that we can hear that message soberly projected and analysed, the better. But ultimately, this does go back to how government seeks to project AUKUS. And I think that it's good to see AUKUS being now projected just as one part of Australia's security response. There's certainly less flag waving around AUKUS than we saw when it was first unleashed as a diplomatic surprise on the world 2 years ago. And I think that's a good thing.
That brings me to another issue, though, and this really brings in your years and years of experience. But in a recent speech, you said, in the years ahead, the real risk of strategic confrontation or even war in our region means the concept of national mobilisation needs to become an accepted part of community thinking, not some quiet bureaucratic plan our political elite would rather not frighten the voters with. What do you mean by that notion of national mobilisation?
So you've hit on one of the more interesting and sensitive lines in a speech I gave last December here at ANU. So I'm delighted that's been picked up. Look, it's mobilisation is a very sensitive word in the policy lexicon. It obviously implies being on effectively a war footing. And I would look at it probably a little bit less starkly than that. I think that if I were, for example, a parliamentarian or a government parliamentarian, not trying to scare the horses, or a minister, I'd probably be using a word like preparedness instead of mobilisation. But deep down within the decision-making structures and the bureaucracy, there needs to be effectively a set of civil defence plans, effectively a plan for how would Australia operate in time of extreme crisis, not necessarily war, and heaven forbid that it would be war, but in times where there was, for example, prolonged strategic confrontation in the region, maritime blockades occurring, some new pandemic, some kind of attack on critical infrastructure or mass cyber event, potential further escalation of the conflict in Europe. Who knows what these scenarios might be? But I think what we do know, and of course the most extreme scenario would be effectively the US and China being at war and Australia effectively being involved in that in some way. It almost doesn't matter which scenario we have in mind. There are a whole lot of difficult futures we have to be ready for. I mean, who among us predicted the COVID-19 pandemic, for example? Who among us imagined that there would be a land war in Europe happening in 2023? I don't think Australia is prepared as a nation for some of those confronting futures. And so I think the prudent thing is putting in place, I guess, the bureaucratic arrangements, but also the national conversation. And this has to be a national political conversation about how do we prepare for shocks and for crises? How do we build national resilience? And of course, I haven't even mentioned the climate emergency. I mean, effectively, many of these these national resilience crises would be induced by climate change or environmental disaster or some combination of bad things happening at once. I think it makes a lot of sense for government to begin a conversation with the private sector, including with universities, with state governments, with the broader public, not to alarm people, not to say get ready for war, but to really talk about how we need to be prepared as a nation. What are some of the expectations that would rest on those of us who are not Commonwealth public servants or national security officials that would have come to pass?
Would, when you talk about national mobilisation or preparedness, would one of those things be the concept of some sort of national service?
So I think I think a conversation is going to begin in time around some kind of national service. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, and it shouldn't mean, anything like the conscription that we saw in the 1960s and 70s and earlier. I also think that it doesn't mean that suddenly everyone is tapped on the shoulder to be some kind of frontline actor in protecting the nation. But I do think there is a latent capacity across the community. A lot of it is manifested in day-to-day volunteering, which Australians have traditionally been very active at. A capacity to support whether it's the government agencies or the Defence Force or the first responders in crises, and for broader parts of the community, and not only younger Australians, but of course younger Australians would have their part in having contributions they could make in disasters, bushfires, floods, critical infrastructure attacks, health emergencies, so that, and really, in a sense, the reason I'm getting to this is so that our relatively small defence force is not called on to do everything. Mm. Because I think that's the real problem that we're facing, is that we have a highly professional but relatively small defence force, you know, sort of 70,000 people or thereabouts, who have been called on to do everything in recent years, from aged care to flood relief to pandemics to regional security responses to combat operations. And in future crises, they will really be needed primarily for what they enlisted for. So that's the national conversation that I think needs to begin. And I think in many ways that can begin much more as a voluntary civilian, a set of voluntary civilian service arrangements, which would overwhelmingly most of the time be about disaster relief. But if Australia did find itself in an international strategic crisis, you would have effectively something of a civilian reserve trained and experienced and networked for non-military, non-combat support to national resilience and survival, you know, literally just keeping the economy going for a start.
Professor Rory Metcalfe, you've given us plenty to think about our position in the Indo-Pacific and the national conversation we need to have moving forward. But thank you very much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to more engagement on how Australian universities can really do their part for the national interest.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.